There is a story told about Rabbi Beryl Wine that just before he spoke, someone gave a 15-minute introduction, at the end of which he said, "With such a long introduction, I can't wait to hear what I have to say." I hope that I am unlike your current Kehillah, Rabbi Belossi, because as you know, I'm a once-a-year man in your shul. On Yom Kippur as well.
That's 600,
right? Yeah. Rabbi Belovsky grew up in northwest London and attended University College Oxford, from where he has a degree in mathematics. He subsequently studied for 7 years in Gateshead. First at Gateshead Yeshiva, from where he has smicha, and then at the Beis HaTalmud Kollel. Between 1997 and 2003, he was the spiritual leader of two communities in Essex. First Loughton and Chigwell, then Ibbot Federation. Since 2003, he has been Rav of the Golders Green Shul. As well as his rabbinical duties, Rabbi Belovsky teaches widely, giving regular classes at Ne Yisrael, JLE, Hasmonean, Oxford Jewish Society and beyond. He is the executive director of the outreach organisation Encounter, and is also a dating counsellor, the senior tutor of the Hamaor Institute, where he teaches outreach techniques, and a member of the committee of the Rabbinical Council of the United Synagogue. He is a popular lecturer at dinners, schools and special events in the UK and abroad. His special areas of interest include study of Mishnah, experimental synagogue programming, pre-marriage training for young couples, and the development of independent-minded students. He's also recently spoken at the Start Your Day the Torah Way, which, if anybody doesn't go to that, 8:30 till 9, Leaside Present. He's the author of two books published by Targum, a translation of the Hasidic classic Shemi Shmuel and the Shara Hasidic Companion, and has written numerous articles for Hamodiah, the London Jewish Chronicle, and other publications. He lives in Golders Green, London, with his wife Vicky and their 6 children. Without further ado, I'd like to call upon Rabbi Belovsky to give us his address.
I say that Sir Jerry read that crucifix at his own. Yeshua's word Asra. And all those who have, for reasons unclear to me, decided to invite me to be the speaker this evening. My old friend Paul Taylor contacted me a little while ago, and I said to him, "I'm not familiar with the audience." So I said to him, "Can you give me some guidelines?" He said, "Look, nothing witty." "Is there not anything else?" "Yeah, some humorous." He said, "Nothing intelligent." So he said, "In fact, just be yourself." You know, as a communal rap, Rob, I spend a lot of time giving people personal advice. A little while ago, we had a simple in the shul, and I decided to begin with the following. A lot of you are probably fed up with me beginning my speeches with jokes, and then a spurious and pathetic attempt to link that to what I'm going to say afterwards. So I promise you today, I'm not going to do that. There will be no spurious and pathetic attempt to link it to what comes afterwards. So I said, instead of starting with some kind of made-up story, allow me to share with you a direct experience. You're probably aware that I give a lot of people very personal and extremely private advice. In fact, some of you are in the audience. And I'd like to share one of this week's occasions with you. I promise you, Alice, 3 people, women say, went green. They obviously thought I was about to say what they'd been to say to me anyway. The story's as follows. A man came to see me. And he said, "Rabbi, I've got quite a serious problem." I said, "Go ahead, you can talk to me." He said, "My wife's trying to poison me." I said, "Oh, come on, you know people have sharp bias issues, but that's ridiculous. You know, I promise you, my wife is trying to poison me." So I said, okay, look, tell me about it. I'm sure it's not that bad. And, you know, as he started to tell me the story, this is really serious. He feels uncomfortable eating anything because he thinks, you know, she's poisoning him. So I said, all right, I can see there's a problem. Come back and see me in 2 days and I'll speak to your wife. So he came back 2 days later and he said, Rabbi, have you had a chance? I said, yes, I spoke to your wife on the phone yesterday for 3 hours. So he said, do you have any advice for me? I said, yes. He said, what is it? I said, take the poison. And the problem was that I hadn't noticed. This is not really it's not a true story, just in case you didn't understand that. There was a man sitting at the back in shul, and when I began, I said, please don't look round, because the man who came to see me is sitting in the back row. I promise you. 200 people turned around simultaneously. But unfortunately for me, there was a fellow in the back row that I hadn't noticed who really does have quite serious marital problems. And I got myself in some degree of trouble. It was really not intended to be directed at him. I was walking home from shul with one of my brother Button that Shabbos morning, and he said, Rabbi, we know who you were talking about. And we've been telling him the same thing for years. Anyways, it's a lesson, perhaps a Rabbonim, that's making up stories and getting into serious trouble. Now, I've come back from a rabbinical conference in Baltimore I go to every year called AJOP, which was two weeks ago. And I met with their summer representatives of Yeshiva University, and I came straight to England, had an opportunity to teach my students at Oxford, and it reminded me of the following story, that Yeshiva University is very keen to be treated as a serious university on the scene. And you all know there's only one way to do that. So you have to have a rowing team. You have to have a rowing team. So they get a rowing eight together, and they practice, and then they enter the university trials, and they came last. So they're obviously not trying harder, they get stronger, more muscular people, they train more, and then they came last in the trials again. So they realise something's not going quite right, so they dispatch a spy to Oxford University to hide in the bushes and watch the training. So they did this, and he comes back, he watches, he spies, he comes back, and he reports back to Yeshiva University. He said, what did you see? He said, unbelievable. You can't believe what they do there. He said, well, what is it? He said, you know, in Oxford, they have 7 people rowing and 1 person shouting. You know, these days, if you're getting through the customs in America, since there have been various terrorist things, it's quite serious business. You have to put your finger on this thing that glows, and you have to look into the camera, and so on. And it's a whole business, even getting out. Well, I'm standing in the queue, and there's a person in the next queue, and they're going through his bags. And inside the bag, they find 5 pairs of solid gold false teeth. So, of course, immediately heard, what's this? What's this? So, what is this, sir? He goes, I'm very religious. He says, yes. Can you explain why you have all these false teeth, sir? He says, I'm very religious. He said, you understand, we Jews, we have separate plates for milking meat. And we have separate cutlery for milk and separate pots. So, I'm very religious. So, I have 2 sets of... one for milk. And 1 for meat. I'll drop the accent if you don't mind. 1 for milk and 1 for meat. Very nice. Very nice. But that's only 2. He said, yes, but you haven't heard of Pesach. Right? So it comes to Pesach. I'd have another set. 1 for milk and 1 for meat. He said, very nice. I've never heard anything like this. I know lots of religious Jews. I've never heard of this before. All right. But what's the other set for? That's only 4. What's the 5th one? He goes, well, from time to time, I like to have a ham sandwich. So we got on the plane, ready to return to England. And it was quite a delay. And 2 gentlemen who appeared to be wearing dark glasses and white sticks were helped onto the plane. And they were shown straight into the cockpit. So it's raised some consternation with the passengers. And then the plane starts through here. Hello, I'm Captain So-and-so, with the usual announcements. And then the plane starts to taxi along the runway. And then it reaches takeoff speed. But it did not take off. And it's going and going extremely fast. Extremely fast. And people start to get worried. And then people realise that something serious is about to happen. If you go far enough, you're going to hit something. And then there's a building tension. Suddenly people start to scream. People start to scream. And just when it was almost too late, the plane lifted up into the air, narrowly missing the building. And in the cockpit, one said to the other, you know, one day, they're not going to scream. Right. You can think about it. I'll explain it after if you have trouble understanding it. And finally, I slept most of the way back. I think I've already fed up with my plane journey by now. But on the way back, I noticed there was a group of Jewish women on the other side of the aisle. And I noticed that the steward came along and said, excuse me, ladies, is anything okay? I've decided at this stage to cut out the other 11. I want to talk to you about a concept that arises from a pasuk very close to the end of the sefer we read today. This is a difficult Rashi. Rashi quoting the Gemara in Sanhedrin. On a word that you all know, the word totophos. This word is translated as frontlets or ornaments, and it refers to the head tefillin. Some Rishonim understand the meaning of this word to refer to something that people will look at, and they will remember the miracle, and as a result, the miracle of the Exodus will be in people's minds. But this is not how Rashi, quoting this Gemara in Sanhedrin, chooses to see it. Rashi takes this word totophos, and he says it's a composite word. There's tot and phos. Tot means two, apparently, in Caspi, some kind of Caspian language. And phos means two in Afriki, some kind of African language. So there you go. It's two and two, four. Here you have an object comprising of four parts. Hence, there you go, that's what its head to fill in is. It's an item with four subcompartments. This is a very, very difficult Rashi. Is Rashi telling us the Torah doesn't have a word for four? He can't find a word in Lashon HaKodesh, in Hebrew, that would express this concept. And instead needs to pick a word from a language you've never heard of. And pick another word from another language we've never heard of. And stick them together to make them into a single word. This is an extremely difficult idea. And quite a lot of head-breaking has gone on trying to understand this. I mean, it should raise some eyebrows. What is the Torah doing here? This is not the only place where this issue arises, but it's a particularly relevant one because the Gemara goes out of its way to give this very strange explanation. It's not pretty, before I come back and eventually answer the question, to examine the nature of Hebrew, to help us to understand exactly what Hebrew is, why it's so significant, and perhaps understand that we live in a world where translation is critical. So how many people here have not profited in some way or other from the Ars Gol Gemara, or the Ars Gol Chumash Rashi, or many hundreds of other translations of books that precede Ars Gol, and other people in other languages, books in French, books in Spanish, books in Russian. It's invaluable. It's transformed the Jewish world. It's fascinating to note that Chazal were already aware of this idea, the need to translate. There's a mitzvah, which many people do, called Shnai Mikra Ve'echod Targum. A mitzvah that every week one should read the parsha, twice in the original, and once in the Aramaic translation. So, of course, this was written in a time where Aramaic was the vernacular, and the reader was encouraged to familiarise himself with the Hebrew text, and then understand it, reading it in the vernacular translation, the Aramaic. So there are discussions in halacha, will it do to read it in English? Let's not worry about that. What is fascinating is that it's referred to often in halacha books by the Rosh Tevis, the letters Shemois, Shnayim Mikra Ve'echod Targum. Very interesting. Shemois is a book of exile. It's a book of a people leaving their land, leaving behind their language, and moving into a different culture, different circumstances. This is the beginning, if you like, the first place in the Torah where one sees a need to somehow transpose Judaism, understand it within the context, and present it within the language, vocabulary, and terminology of a new era. This idea that it's important to understand the original, yet translate it, is appreciated by Chazal, and they even can find, if you like, a hint to it in the Torah originally. There is a need to translate the Torah in every circumstance, and this does not mean translating into English. It does not mean translating it into anything other than the terminology of the audience who are going to hear it. Otherwise, they won't hear it. There is a discussion in many early sources as to the precise nature of Hebrew. This language we call Loshon HaKodesh, the Holy Tongue. The Rambam famously says, it's a holy language because there are no rude words in it. Anything which we would consider rude or personal, intimate, is usually referred to by some kind of euphemism. There's no direct word for a range of things, and words that are used in modern Hebrew tend to be borrowed from other languages, or are adjusted from other words that actually mean things altogether different. The Rambam says something not dissimilar. There's the concept of God's communication. It's the language of God. It's the language that the whole world spoke before Migdal Bavel, before the dispersal. It's the language of the Ovis. It's the language with which God spoke to mankind. It's quoted from God. It's not into Hebrew. That's the words. I am the Lord your God. God speaks in Hebrew, and if God speaks in Hebrew, there must be something special or remarkable about it. But there is another approach, and eventually, with a little more time, we can use this approach to wind back to our dealing with our problematic Russian Gemara and Sanhedrin. Hebrew is no less than the source of all languages. Hebrew expresses concepts in a way that no other language does. Many great philosophers, theorists, thinkers have examined the nature of language, the relationship between language and the words or concepts that it expresses. Anyone knows anything about Wittgenstein, Beetles in Boxes, maybe I'll tell you something a little bit about this, about how you only have, once the box is closed and there's a beetle inside it, all you have is your perception. This means you have a beetle, and it doesn't matter what's in there. I'm referring to it as a beetle, in my mind it's a beetle. Language expresses some kind of connection. As long as when I say beetle, you all know what I mean by beetle, that will do. When I say love, as long as you all know what I mean by love, that will do. Hebrew is completely unlike any other language in this regard. Hebrew is an intrinsic language. There is something about the letters, the shape of the letters, the concepts that the letters convey, and therefore the combination of letters that form syllables and eventually words, which express things which are intrinsic, which express the very idea, the notion that lies behind this object or concept. In Parshas Bereishis, we see Adam HaRishon naming all the animals. This is the first thing he has to do. So he's brought a line of animals, and he looks at this big grey thing, and he goes, pill, right? That's an elephant. And is that what it means? That's all. This is the only job that God can give to man. This actually expresses a very profound concept. That the word that Adam HaRishon chooses for a particular animal, this expresses an intimate understanding of the essence, the nature of this animal, what distinguishes it from all other animals, and he expresses that, encapsulates it in the language of God. Part of the creative process is given over to man, by which he can name, understand, relate to. Chazal expressed it in a very graphic way. They say Adam HaRishon had an intimate relationship with every animal. Of course it does not mean any kind of physical relationship. But it means he understood it, he appreciated it, he penetrated to its very core, and then he named it. Because Loshon HaKodesh, the language which Adam spoke, and with which God communicated with him, expresses the prime, the core concept of every entity. And in this regard, Loshon HaKodesh, Hebrew, is distinct from every other language where words are conventions. Examples. The word Yad. Right? The Rambam likes the word Yad. He calls his book Yad, Yad Chazoka. Why? A Yad is a hand. Well, a Yad has gematria 14, and hand has 14 joints. There's some yad at hand. That's all at a simple level. Other examples, we can go on and on. famous example is the word oizen, which is an ear. Moznayim are scales. Scales, weighing scales, not fish scales, weighing scales. I discovered that it wasn't until 1905 that the relationship was established between hearing and balance by science. How fascinating that in Tanakh, the same word for a balance, something that weighs things up, balance and ear are just the same word. Those are concepts which go far beyond convention. But perhaps the most fascinating of all of them is the word mayim. And this will enable us to begin to understand another aspect of the significance of Hebrew. The word mayim. So what does it mean? First of all, it's plural. In English, we have water and waters. They mean something slightly different. But in Hebrew, there's no singular. It's mayim. Everything's plural. Now, this is important to understand. This is not like kreplach, right? The reason why kreplach is always plural is because no one only ever eats one, right? This is not the same kind of thought process, right? Knevach and so on, right? Mayim is plural because it cannot be referred to in the concept of Hebrew as singular. The thinkers will tell us that the word mayim is a collection of maz. It's a collection of whats. What does that mean? It means that in the Torah particularly, and this is brought out particularly in the thought of the Maharal, that mayim represents pure, untrammeled physicality. It has no shape, it has no form. In the terminology of the Maharal, it is choymer belitzura. It is raw material with no form applied to it at all. What is it? That is its identity. It isn't anything other than what is it? It's a collection of whats. And that concept, that what is something which is other, which has no entity other than that which is imposed on it externally. You put it in a bucket, you get bucket-shaped water. You put it in a bowl, you get bowl-shaped water, etc. That concept will enable us to properly understand the Rashi from where we began. Because the notion that water is the unknowable, it's the what, appears in other languages. Because the Latin, what is the Latin for water? Aqua. What does qua mean? Means what? What does vasera mean? Right. And water comes from the same word as well. I had lunch with a Frenchman today and tried to establish where the word O comes from. He said he thought it was actually came originally from the Latin, although he wasn't sure. It's fascinating to see that even in other languages, which have these words have no apparent Hebrew roots at all, the concept that Hebrew tells us we understand as water. This concept somehow and remarkably appears in Latin and German. Fascinating. Of course, it doesn't appear in every language, but it's remarkable that Vasser and Aqua are exactly the same idea as Mayim. All of this enables us to understand the Rashi, which will give us an insight and then perhaps pause for thought and then I can sit down. In fact, I'm going to go away. I'm going to go somewhere else afterwards. The Shulchan Kodesh explains that every language contains in it remnants right going back to the dispersal of mankind where there was one language, the concepts. Although everyone then spoke a new language, a different language, which is why the Tower broke down, there were concepts that they had from their original conceptual language, the language of Hebrew, which they took with them and they built languages based on these ideas. The reason the Shulchan would say that water in Latin is aqua and German is Wasser is because the notion of water, mayim, somehow or other found its way into those languages and expressed itself, albeit in their own words, in their own vocabulary, in their own syntax. So the Shulchan Kodesh explains that the words tot and fos, these are not words. The Rashi and the Gemara are not telling us that these are, the Torah suddenly can't find a word for the number four. These are Hebrew words. These are Hebrew constructs. We're not familiar with them. We've lost our understanding. We only discover them because they are used in other languages. But we're not being told that the Torah suddenly decides just that it doesn't know a word for four or an object of construction of two twos. These are Hebrew words. And what the Gemara is telling us is that we can only see them in our time because they've been lost as part of Hebrew by seeing them in other languages. And hence, Tosafot is a Hebrew word. And the Shlach understands this the way the Gemara is to be understood. Just as an aside, there is much written, particularly by the Hisharim and also by the Tosh Shiva, about the concept of language. And the Shura does. There's some fascinating ideas about language and about how all these ideas we've seen so far mean that each language expresses something very powerful about the nation that uses it. So if you want to learn something about the very core values of Italians, for example, if you have enough sensitivity to the tone, the nuances, the syntax, and the style and sound of their language, you will be able to find out a great deal about them. And he has, the Chiddush HaRim at least, has one or two quite unpleasant things to say about particular nations, seeing their language and style of expression as evidence of certain unpleasant qualities. I'll spare you that on this occasion. We go back to our original point. Shmois, Shnai Mikveh Echot Targum. Hebrew is untranslatable. We've just discovered that the way Hebrew functions, the way words fit together, cannot be conveyed in any other language. Every translation is an approximation. This might explain why Chazal was so distressed by the Targum Shivim, by the Septuagint. Not because they couldn't convey the text from Hebrew accurately into Greek, but because any translation, by definition, we're not translating from French into German, or from Eskimo into Swahili. That doesn't matter so much. But we're translating Hebrew into anything, in many ways, will by definition destroy its core identity. Perhaps that's why Chazal wants to fast on Sorbet Aves, because it's a serious business. It was necessary, and translation is vital, but we have to understand what we lose. And therefore, I'm advocating that we appreciate it's vital not just to translate into English, but to translate concepts into terminology, into a style that people can understand. And every speaker has to know, I go speak to my students in Oxford, they require different sort of presentations to the presentation that we give here, or in a completely different environment altogether. We have to understand that people can only appreciate and recover from our language, vocabulary, and style of presentation that suits their world and fits their world. That's Shemois, the Jewish people leaving the centre, going into exile, and the need to translate the Torah into a language they can understand. We have to also appreciate there's a balance. In the long run, Judaism in translation isn't going to do anything for us, because the concepts that in Hebrew contain are untranslatable. Someone once said to me that the nearest approximation to the content of Hebrew is chemical notation. You've got CO2. So the word in chemical notation, CO2, has bits that are built of what the object itself is that it describes. That's about as close as we're going to get. I have not yet seen a translation of Tanakh into chemical notation. I don't think one is forthcoming just at the moment. So the message is that we have to be capable of transmitting ideas to all sorts of people. We want the Jewish world to grow and to develop. And for the most intelligent, the most distant people to feel touched by Torah, we have to translate, we have to explain, we have to put things in a way that people can understand. Yet we always have to retain the balance that the long-term goal is that Judaism and its concepts can only properly be understood through Lashon HaKodesh. Oh.